Hey there, just a quick note. This episode contains descriptions of violent crimes and death row executions. This is In Conversation from Apple News. I'm Shumita Basu. Today, what the death penalty in America really looks like. At the end of President Trump's first term, his administration resumed federal executions after a 17-year pause, carrying out 13 executions in just 6 months. At the time, Elizabeth Brunig was a reporter at the New York Times writing about the death penalty.
Capital punishment has interested me for a while. There's nothing else really like it in society where we kill fully healthy civilians. And I felt like I couldn't really justify my feelings on it either way, or really even understand my feelings on it unless I saw it for myself.
In 2020, Elizabeth decided to volunteer as a media witness to a federal execution in Indiana and write about what she saw. She continued to cover the issue as a staff writer at The Atlantic, where she wrote about witnessing 5 executions over the course of 5 years, including 2 failed attempts. She grew close to several inmates on death row and their families. And Elizabeth says that all of this, plus her own experience grappling with justice after the murder of her sister-in-law in 2016, has reshaped how she thinks about the death penalty.
My initial stance had been, even if someone is the worst person in the world, it's wrong to execute them. But what I found was these people are not necessarily the worst people in the world. They're people who've done terrible things. But in many, many cases, these are people who have radically changed over the years that they have been incarcerated. And I came away much more disturbed by capital punishment than I had been to begin with.
Elizabeth's piece for The Atlantic, Inside America's Death Chambers, explores the ethical tension between revenge, mercy, and redemption. I started by asking her to describe that first execution she witnessed back in 2020 of a man named Alfred Bourgeois at a federal prison in Terre Haute, Indiana.
One of the things that shocked me about the execution process is that it's very mundane for the people who are carrying out the execution. So when media witnesses show up, they process us and they check you in, move you around via vans so you don't know exactly where you are. On the prison grounds, I was led into the execution chamber, which was just a small building. They're usually separate from the prison. And there are different people present at the execution. So the victim's family is offered the opportunity to witness the execution. There are state-sanctioned media witnesses whose job it is to observe the execution, basically to provide some level of transparency on this government activity. And then there are the personal witnesses of the offender who is to be executed. These can be members of their family, spiritual advisors, sometimes their lawyers or friends. And you sit down in this case, it was a very hot cinder block room with a box fan blowing. You sit in plastic chairs, you look at a window with a curtain. And when the curtain is drawn aside, you see the offender, in this case, it was a man named Alfred Bourgeois, strapped to a sort of cruciform gurney with his arms out and IV lines set. The setting of the IV line process is hidden. The state doesn't allow any witnesses to see that part. The tubes that are attached to the offender where the lethal drugs flow snake through this hole in the wall so that no one knows who is administering the lethal drugs or when they administer them. But shortly after we sat down in the execution chamber, Mr. Bourgeois was read his death warrant by, I believe, the warden of Terre Haute, and then offered the opportunity to give last words, at which point he said he was innocent. Then at some point, they didn't really notify us. The lethal drugs began to flow, and he started jerking, heaving, writhing on the gurney, which was shocking to me because that's not quite how lethal injection is advertised. It's supposed to be sort of quick and painless, like going under for surgery or going to sleep, something like that. But just judging from what I could see, it appears to be a much more torturous process than it's given credit for.
And you write about this and describe that Bourgeois is a deeply unsympathetic figure. Mm-hmm. What did you know about him at this point?
So I read the police file, and I read some of the defense briefs, and I read some of the state's briefs. So I had a good sense of the crime that had taken place. And what Mr. Bourgeois was guilty of was the murder of his toddler daughter. Her name was Jacqueline. He was a long-haul truck driver dropping off a shipment at Corpus Christi, which is a naval base in Texas. At that time, he shook the child and or banged her head against the inside of the cabin of his truck until she died. Prosecutors would later say that not only did he murder her, but that he sexually abused her. And the defense really called that into question. You know, the sexual abuse was never adjudicated. He wasn't charged and tried. So the state never really had to put much evidence up for scrutiny. They were just allowed to accuse him of this. And, you know, in my view, that is likely what caused the jury to sentence him to death, is that aggravating factor of a sexual component. And this is not a sympathetic thing to hear. This is not the person you would choose as a poster boy for why capital punishment is wrong. You know, my daughters at that point were quite young, and it's hard to connect with someone in that situation.
Yeah, yeah. You describe how his body was heaving mm-hmm. at the time when the injection was given. How long did it appear to take for him to die by lethal injection?
I think it took 8 minutes for Alfred Bourgeois to die. And that, I think, was surprising to a lot of people in the witness chamber. But come to find out, that was actually a fairly short amount of time for lethal injection. It can take much longer.
Mm. Mm. And what did you walk out of there feeling and thinking that day?
You know, I was completely mixed up after I left the execution chamber because I had felt that I would oppose what was happening. But I had imagined myself having a nice, stable professional distance. And I thought to myself, there will probably be some kind of catharsis for someone considering that he did something so terrible. Capital punishment is supposed to redress the most terrible crimes by an equally terrible punishment. And that's designed for some kind of catharsis. But there wasn't any of that. It was just unnatural. It was disturbing. I was sick to my stomach. I puked on the concrete outside the execution chamber.
Mm. Let's back up a bit and talk about this moment in capital punishment in America. Can you give me a sense of where we're at? What has happened in the past few decades?
Sure. So capital punishment in the United States has been on the decline for a long time, and it's been on the decline by various different measures. So there are fewer executions now than there were during the height of the use of the death penalty in the 90s. The number of death warrants given out have declined. The number of death sentences sought by prosecutors have declined. And those are long-term trends. What's going on right now is a spike in the other direction. So this has a lot to do with the personal politics of President Trump, who during his first campaign was very adamant that he would bring back executions, and I think has even mused about group executions or public executions, bringing back those types of executions. So under Trump, states seem to have been provoked to ramp up their executions as well. That's just something that this administration views as a priority. Mm. So Texas, Oklahoma, you know, the usual suspects have been executing people at a much higher rate lately than they have in the past decades.
Mm. President Trump even issued an executive order this year directing federal prosecutors to aggressively pursue the death penalty. So he spelled it out in executive order. And the language that he used is that the death penalty is designed to be the ultimate deterrent to crime.
Mm-hmm.
How true is that? What do we know about whether it is actually effective at deterring crime?
So I think a lot of people who support the death penalty support it because it's something of a deterrent. And there's absolutely no evidence that capital punishment deters crime. People who commit crimes are oftentimes doing it in the heat of the moment. They're not rationally sketching out how they're going to commit this crime and what's going to happen afterwards. I would say that kind of behavior is exceedingly rare. I think one of the biggest problems for people who think capital punishment is a major deterrent is that states that have capital punishment have higher homicide rates than states that don't. And so that's hard to explain if capital punishment is meant to be such a major deterrent.
Interesting. I went looking for some data on this too. And actually, I was really curious to find some polling data and to just better understand where Americans are on this issue. And I came across some polling from 2021 from the Pew Research Center that said 60% of U.S. adults support the death penalty for people who've been convicted of murder. 39% oppose it. And interestingly, sort of similar to that percentage, 63% of adults say that the death penalty doesn't deter people from committing crimes. Like, they know that it doesn't seem to be a good deterrent. And yet just as many people support it or are in favor of it. What do you make of public perception on this issue?
So, you know, support for the death penalty in the United States is at an all-time low. And so, you know, I think you see different specific numbers. Pew puts it at something like 60%. Gallup has recently put it at something like 55%. It's definitely a majority of people in the United States who support capital punishment, but a rapidly slimming majority. One bit of data that I think about all the time was that even people who admit that capital punishment kills innocent people oftentimes support the death penalty. And it's hard for me to understand exactly what is driving the support at that point, because the traditional justifications seem to have really fallen apart. And so I think that people just have very emotional responses to very terrible crimes, which I completely understand. And I have those same responses myself. But translating that into capital punishment seems like, I think, a way to discharge some of those emotions. But again, I think it's a very faulty and unreliable way of trying to give people closure or catharsis or something.
I mean, I can't help but think that maybe some of what's affecting public opinion and lessening support for the death penalty is we're starting to hear many stories about how many executions go wrong. And you've said that there are more regulations and provisions in place to safely euthanize pets than there are to kill people in this country. Can you say more about the state of safety of humane treatment and rules around how we treat people?
Yes. So there are definitely more regulations in place for euthanizing pets than for executing people. One of the major ones is that, you know, when you're euthanizing a pet, a vet is present, a doctor. When you're executing a human being, there's not necessarily a doctor involved at all. Lethal injection is, you know, the most common form of execution these days. It has been for a while. And I think it comes with a lot more problems than people recognize. One of the problems is always setting the IV line, finding a vein and getting a needle successfully hooked up and a catheter in there. Oftentimes, execution staff struggle with this. And I suspect that's because there are very few members of the medical profession who are willing to be involved in executions. This is probably for a number of reasons. People who go into the medical profession usually aren't planning on killing people. That's sort of the opposite of their intention.
It goes against the oath they took, right, as medical professionals.
Right. And in some states, participating in executions could challenge or, you know, provide grounds for challenging someone's medical licensure. And so the EMTs who are involved in actually setting the lines and administering the drugs, their identities are kept completely secret. And there are people who one assumes aren't necessarily getting along so well in the medical profession, and they struggle.
Let's talk about an execution that didn't go as planned. Can you tell us the story of Kenneth Smith, who it sounds like you became pretty close to?
Yeah, Kenny. Kenny When he was a very young man in his 20s, back in the 80s in Alabama, was approached by a local criminal and asked if he wanted to participate in a murder-for-hire plot. A pastor in this Alabama town had decided he wanted his wife, Elizabeth Sennett, dead. And Kenny and a co-conspirator and a partner were supposed to make that happen, were supposed to kill her. At the actual event of the murder, Kenny's job was to ransack the house and make it look like a robbery. Kenny said he didn't beat or attack Miss Sennett, and his co-conspirator who did beat and attack Miss Sennett also never said Kenny was involved, even though it would have probably been beneficial for him. And no forensic evidence ever linked Kenny to the actual murder, so he was convicted of capital murder. I don't mean to say any of that by way of excusing what he did. It was terrible, and he himself admitted that. But that is his background. So when I met Kenny, he was very polite, he was very cordial, he was very warm and friendly. And this is someone who had a date to die quite near in the future when we met, just months. And I was there for that execution. That was supposed to be a lethal injection. But the people who were responsible for setting the IV lines couldn't do it. They tried his arms, they tried his hands, they tried a foot. And finally, as they were getting sort of panicked that this wasn't happening, they took like a heavy gauge surgical needle and rammed it under his collarbone to try to hook up with a subclavian vein. Oh. And they couldn't do that either. And so, you know, there was a lot of blood, and the clock struck midnight, signaling the expiration of Kenny's death warrant before the state actually managed to kill him. What that meant was that they had to stop all efforts and go back to the court, request a new death warrant, a process that took some time. So that failed execution left Kenny extremely psychologically shattered. He was in a lot of pain afterwards. I know people aren't necessarily sympathetic to the pain of prisoners, but he couldn't lift his arm and was otherwise very injured. But I think the most serious injury was to his psychological state. In, you know, mock executions, which is what Kenny underwent, was a mock execution banned by the Geneva Convention. Mm. That's considered torture. Mm. After that, Kenny had some time to litigate his case. And nevertheless, the state was able to, in spite of that botch, get a new death warrant for Kenny, this time using nitrogen hypoxia to get around the legal challenges that arose from their failed lethal injection.
Mm, and you write about nitrogen hypoxia in your piece. Some officials have described it as a more humane option than lethal injection, although many experts would push back on that description. And while it's only been used in executions a few times so far, more states are starting to adopt it, right?
That's right. So nitrogen hypoxia is a method that aims to suffocate a person using nitrogen gas. I should say, the idea for nitrogen hypoxia as an execution method was pioneered by a screenwriter named Stuart Creek, who just recognized the fact that occasionally people die in nitrogen suffocation in industrial accidents. That does occasionally happen. And what he noted is that people who die of nitrogen suffocation in industrial accidents often don't realize that the oxygen content of the air is dropping. And so they're still breathing normally, they're breathing, but there's less and less oxygen making it into the bloodstream. This is often something that people don't realize until they're unconscious and then they're dead. So Stuart Creek had this idea that it would be wonderful as an execution method because the person would keep breathing normally. There wouldn't be poison gas in play as there had in gas chamber executions. And it would be just like passing out and then passing away. And surprise, surprise, that's not how it works.
Wow.
Kenny was the first person in the world executed by nitrogen hypoxia. Alabama put together their nitrogen hypoxia chamber in secret. All of the vendors who worked with them were kept secret. There was a Tennessee company at one point that was contracted to help them build the execution chamber that backed out after protesters got in touch. So it was sort of this long process that, you know, appeared to be kind of ramshackle. They wound up using an industrial gas mask that they had just repurposed with a valve stuck in it hooked up to a tank of nitrogen. And, you know, probably unsurprisingly, it took Kenny a long time to die. It was a suffocation death. It was very difficult. And he choked and heaved and gasped for air and everything you would do if you were fully aware that you were dying by suffocation. And I think what surprised everyone the most was that it took Kenny, I think, something over 20 minutes to actually die.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God. And you were witnessing it with his family?
I was there with his family, yeah. I was supposed to witness the execution, but earlier in the day of the execution, I had been visiting with Kenny in prison. And the warden of the prison caught me with a pen, which they decided was dangerous and not permitted. Even though lawyers are allowed to have pens, so they don't seem like that big of a safety risk, whatever. They pulled me off the witness list in retaliation for me having that pen. So I was there supporting Kenny's family. I didn't see the actual execution, but I was there for them immediately after. And it was Kenny's mother, Kenny's wife, Kenny's sons, and their wives. His family loved him very much. He was very much a family man. It's, you know, one thing that happens when people go to prison, especially for life, is that they lose people. People move on. They forget about them. They form other relationships. They go different directions with their lives. And oftentimes this is true of family. Kenny was different. There is a lot of love in Kenny's life. And I know for some people that will probably be hard to hear because prison is supposed to be a punishment. And we sort of imagine that there ought to be no comfort for anyone in that circumstance. But Kenny had his family. And, you know, I think about that a lot when I think about how his life ended.
Yeah. What is the actual challenge in finding a peaceful way to put someone to death?
I think that one of the major challenges is that the people who are dying in executions do not want to die. So there is a level of resistance and there is a level of, you know, psychological terror, anxiety that makes these executions difficult. And if you're thinking about someone taking lethal drugs in a medical assistance and dying context, this is a person who's ready and prepared and willingly taking the medication, often in a comfortable location with people there to look after them. That's a very different circumstance than someone who is having poison injected into their veins while they're tied down to a gurney. I think that for a lot of people who support capital punishment, it's exactly that kind of terror and anxiety and maybe even cruelty and difficulty in the executions that makes it all worthwhile because it's supposed to be a punishment after all. The problem with that is that's torture.
Yeah.
And it's very hard to make capital punishment fit with the Eighth Amendment. Mm. And we've been through lots of different methods. Hanging was the longest standing method, firing squad in the military. There was the electric chair, there was the gas chamber, and now there's lethal injection and nitrogen hypoxia. And the reason that we have moved from method to method to method is this drive to find a humane method that no one will complain about. And it just turns out there's no good way to kill somebody.
Yeah. I mean, it sounds like you got close to not just a number of people who'd been sentenced to death, but also their families in the process of this and got to understand their perspective on it. But, I mean, very interestingly, you have another into this topic, and you write about this, that your sister-in-law was murdered. Mm-hmm. And you and your family have had the experience now of having to think about what justice means. Mm-hmm. Can you say a little bit more about that?
My husband and I went to the same high school. That's how we met. And his sister, Heather, had gone to the same high school as well. One day in 2016, I was out with my husband and he got a call from his dad. And I remember him just looking ashen and he kept saying, "What? What? What? And after he got off the phone, he looked just completely dazed, and he told me Heather had been murdered. It was shocking. It was horrifying. It was extremely, I mean, it's hard to even put into words what it's like when a family member is lost to violence, dies by violence. Obviously, his mom and dad were completely crushed, I think, the way that anyone would feel if they lost a child. I imagined, before witnessing how they responded, that anyone who lost a loved one to violence would be angry, would be furious about this thing that was, you know, wrongfully taken from them, the life of their loved one. My husband and his dad, however, are interesting people. They have a very strong sense of justice, and neither of them were interested in retribution. I mean, they wanted the justice system to play out. They expected him to be imprisoned for murder, obviously, but neither of them were interested in pursuing the death penalty or had any type of ideation about the death penalty or wanting this person dead. I think they just wanted it to be over. Mm. And when someone goes to prison for life, in this case, the guy got 40 years, you know, that's it. You know, you don't have to deal with the long process of appeals that comes along with capital punishment, where families of victims are repeatedly asked to, you know, sort of register their feelings. Every time an appeal comes in, the offender wins an appeal, the offender loses an appeal, the prosecutors have the victim's family talk to the press. It's a huge burden for victims' families, and I think that's why a lot of victims' families actually decide they don't want to see the offenders who killed their loved ones executed. Many more people feel that way than I would have guessed.
Yeah, that is surprising. And I'm so sorry for the experience that your family went through. It feels like a lot of your writing is grappling with this idea of mercy and what it should look like. And really this idea of redeemability. Mm-hmm. How has your thinking around these ideas evolved as you have witnessed more executions, talked to more people who have been sentenced to death and their families?
Yeah, so I have like kind of a superstitious belief that truly evil people must exist because, you know, obviously people do evil things and certain people seem more predisposed to do evil things than others. But what I realized is that, you know, while I'm sure those people exist, I've never met one of them. Working with guys on death row, you begin to see the circumstances that led to the crime, the situations that provoked it, and it's oftentimes more complicated than it initially seems. I can think of a couple examples. Kenny is one where, you know, if you heard he carried out a murder for hire plot, you would assume is sort of diabolically evil, an assassin. But that's not who Kenny was. Jimmy Barber is another guy that I met on Alabama's death row who's since been executed. I was there for that. He was on a 3-day crack binge, drunk and taking opioids at the time of his crime and didn't really have clear memories of it. His response to that murder, to finding out that he was guilty, was to completely change his life, radically change his life. Mm. And Jimmy spent the intervening decades of his life, reading the Bible, counseling guys who were on death row, had a spotless record, disciplinary record inside the prison, was never involved in fighting, gangs, drugs, nothing.
I mean, the other amazing thing about Jimmy's story, just to mention, is the granddaughter of his victim eventually reached out to him while he was in prison, right? And they forged a relationship of sorts, and it sounds like she arrived at a place of not wanting to carry the burden of anger, of feelings of seeking revenge. And it really sounds like she healed something in that relationship by reaching out to him and in their continued relationship. It really makes you think, why aren't victims' families considered more in the deciding of the outcome of a lot of these cases?
I think that's a very good question. Oftentimes, when prosecutors decide to seek the death penalty, they attribute their decision to the victim's family. They say the victim's family wants it. This is the only way they'll get closure. And in a lot of cases, that is true. The state seems interested in victims' families only insofar as they support capital punishment, but they don't necessarily seem interested in them when they oppose it, which suggests to me seeking death sentences in a lot of cases is about the prosecutor's wishes and desires and politics in the area, and not so much about anyone's family or anyone's closure. I think that's a sort of smokescreen.
What would a better justice system look like to you? Quite simply, I mean, you've spent so much time thinking about this and talking to people. Given all that input, I mean, what would it actually, what would it mean to have a better and more fair justice system?
I think there are so many pieces and parts of that question, and I can't dive into all of them. But, you know, obviously, I think the death penalty should be abolished. And in most cases of crime, I think, there should be more attention paid to the specific offender, the nuances of the crime. The more we learn about criminogenic circumstances, the more it becomes clear the reason some people are more predisposed to offend. And these are oftentimes reasons beyond their control. Again, I know that's hard to hear because people feel like this is all a big excuse. But the reality is that these things matter and that they do make a moral difference in how one ought to respond to an offender. So an example I would give is, should a 17-year-old who shoots someone in a drug dispute receive the same sentence as a 45-year-old man who shot his ex-wife and her boyfriend or whatever? You know, I think that people can generally see that there's a reason to treat juveniles differently. There's a reason to show mercy in that case. And my suggestion would just be to show mercy as often as possible, to take into account the circumstances of these crimes, the offenders' lives. And a lot of that already goes on. Judges can make sentencing decisions about particular crimes, and oftentimes they're presented with mitigating evidence, and they change their decisions according to that evidence. And I would just say more of that, more openness to that.
Thank you so much, Liz, for your time and for writing so thoughtfully about this.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
You can read Elizabeth Brunig's story for The Atlantic, Inside America's Death Chambers, on Apple News. We'll link to it on our show notes page. And if you're listening in the app, we've queued up that article to play for you next.